Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This is our eighth episode. We call it Far and Away. Stay tuned as we speak with Christoph Rehag from Germany and Philip Schadi here from Austria, and as we discuss their long-distance hiking and long-distance cycling trips around the world. To admit that besides maps, the idea of the expedition is what brought me initially to geography as a discipline and way of thinking about the world. National Geographic articles and photographs inspire the armchair traveler and most definitely get some out of that chair and on the road. Expeditions suggests exploration of terra incognita or the unknown lands. Maybe the 21st century explorer is different though. No polar regions to be the first to arrive. Take the Shackleton adventures and misadventures, for example. The 21st century viewer of the film versions of the polar expeditions is brought back into time when the whole world had not yet been mapped and satellite imagery was still a dream that had not come true. These expeditions required planning, funding, and teams of people as they sought out the unknown. Today, perhaps we're living within the globalization narrative, and we find ourselves closer not only to the North and South Pole, but to all of the continents. No, Pangaea is not reforming, but with the access to high-speed travel, trains, planes, automobiles, we can circumnavigate the globe like never before. Geographers call it the time-space compression. In tonight's episode, Far and Away, I propose that we follow our guests and plan and embark upon our own expeditions into a less compressed time-space. That we take a step back from the fast pace and create more distance, not less, between places in our own worlds. We are currently experiencing the compression of time and space that allows us to know the world and have access to it like never before, even on a tighter budget. But how we travel does not need to be so fast. We can reduce the effect of this compression by traveling between major cities, between places, by foot or bicycle. You never know what you'll find at that pace. Our first guest tonight is Christoph Rehag. He joins us from Hamburg, Germany. I first found out about him from his book called The Longest Way, describing his journey on foot from Beijing with the goal to arrive in Germany. He joins us from there over the phone. You know, you said you were living in Beijing when you set out on the expedition, if we can call it that. And so you spoke Chinese, you spoke Mandarin, is that?
It's basically my major in German university.
Okay.
I'm a China studies major. So
all
that's
right.
What I'm supposed to do, just speak Chinese and do whatever is connected with China. And then I ended up in Beijing to pursue studies of Chinese and then cinematography in the film academy in the north of Beijing. And I did that for 2 years. And then I got this idea to just use... use my youth, use my ability to speak Chinese and maybe learn other languages, I don't know, and use the stuff that I'd learned in cinematography and just go back on foot and kind of document the process. That was the idea.
Excellent. Did you use this as kind of like a a thesis project or a degree-ending project? Was this?
It didn't really have anything to do with my classes. I have never been a very I wasn't a bad student, but I didn't really enjoy being in a university. I don't know. Some people are just like that. I don't like kind of hovering around in the library looking at books. I like to just kind of get out there. Maybe it's an excuse to be lazy and not study, but I liked kind of diving into the Chinese countryside and checking out stuff that I can't find in the books. But nobody in school knew about it or cared about it for that matter.
Right. So doing
a private project.
Doing by learning. I mean, it sounds really interesting in terms of a bit of a critique of formalized sort of academic learning, spending perhaps too much time in a library, especially someone maybe interested in area or regional studies or geography or those kinds of social sciences. It's to kind of be out there and be in the world, actually asking those questions. I'm sure you were kind of exploring things with your camera and the lens as well. Do you see like taking a trip like this? And again, I'll use this word expedition. I think it's a good way of thinking about the learning process too, is to just by going out. And I think it sounds pretty interesting the way you're describing that the university didn't necessarily always give you that. And so you found it for yourself through sort of this trip, this expedition. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme or perhaps a question and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. Now let's get back to our episode. I guess one of the questions that I wanted to ask was, what did you have, like, I mean, I guess we always have some kind of preconceived ideas of what we're going to encounter, what we're going to run into. Were there really good surprises? I mean, did you have, like, entering into certain parts of China, did you say, wow, this is even better than I ever imagined? And what were the kinds of things that maybe kind of triggered that feeling off?
I would have to say I was very surprised that at some point I didn't have an idea about this. I was just looking at the GPS and it kept telling me that the altitude was getting higher and higher. So I'm walking, and then maybe today it's 1,000 meters, and then after a few weeks it's 2,000 and 3,000, and suddenly I find myself in an area that actually belongs to Tibet, geographically and culturally. So then you have Tibetans all around you and Lamaist monasteries, yaks, and you're in an area where the average altitude is just higher than the highest mountains that we have here in Germany, where we're so proud of the mountain. And then over there, it would actually be a hole, because it's not higher than the plateau. So yeah, this, and I'm not a mountain person. I'm from the north of Germany, so. I'm always very happy when I can see the ocean. I don't know why. I guess you have ocean people and you have mountain people and maybe desert people or something.
Right.
But these expanses of the open ocean, they make me scared and they make me happy at the same time. The mountains never did that. But in Tibet, when you're on a plateau, and it's not that Alp feeling of being caged in into a little valley, like a thing that you would put on top of a cheese platter. You're kind of caged in. It's not like that. You're very open on a very, very large, spacious plateau. That was really, really nice. And I can suddenly understand how people can like the mountain so much, because I used to never be able to understand it. You know, I studied in Munich for 6 years, I think, and people would say, okay, let's go to the mountain over the weekend. And I'm like, nah. I don't know. I mean, I'm not that big of a fan of walking, actually.
You're not?
Or hiking, if you're going to say that. No. I like to walk around as a means of experiencing things. I like to just kind of get myself in situations that I think are interesting.
Right.
But I don't walk for the sake of walking. I don't like walking on a treadmill. I don't like walking to places that I've walked to before. And I definitely don't like to walk up a mountain and then walk the same way back. I don't know. It doesn't really make that much sense if you don't like the mountains that much. It's not like I hate them, but in Tibet, I like them. And that was the first thing, if you're talking about a very specific area. But in general, I had been to some of the parts that I visited on the longest way on the walk before by train. So like the Terracotta Army in Xi'an, I had been there before. But I remember the first time I saw it, I didn't really like it that much. I thought, okay, so here you have a hole, and in the hole you have all these dudes made of clay, and they all look the same to me.
Right.
So what's so great about that? You know, like, I don't know if you've been to the Louvre, right?
Sure, sure.
And you look at the Mona Lisa, and everybody has the same reaction. They're like, this is it? Seriously? You know, it's not even as big as my TV at home, and it certainly doesn't look that good.
Right.
It's just the Mona Lisa. So this is what I came here for. So the Terracotta Army, the first time I went there, wasn't that bad, but wasn't that good either. And the second time when I walked there, it was totally different, because I could just feel the size of the whole thing. Not just the army, but also the distance of the grave mound, which is about, I think, 3 miles away, and the army. So this guy, he makes a grave for himself somewhere, and he makes this huge mound on top of that grave, which could be a pyramid, and it would be the same size basically as a pyramid in Egypt, but they put earth on top of it and plant trees, so it looks like a mountain. And then when you're standing on top of that thing, and you just walk there from the Terracotta Army, which is like a half hour walk away, you're thinking, okay, this is huge. This is really, really huge. Like, if the Terracotta Army is connected to this grave,
uh-huh.
and you just walk a half hour from there to here, then everything in between is also connected to the grave, which people haven't opened yet. And then I just felt, okay, this is really awesome. Like, you need this sort of imagination and maybe having had a more physical approach to the whole thing. And then you feel like, okay, this was a very, very big idea. This was a very determined dude who forced all these people to do this, and it was a huge empire. I mean, just walking there from Beijing took like 2 months, you know. Huh. And then you're thinking, okay, so this guy, at that point in time, there was no other way for him to move around either. Like, he could go on horse or in a caravan or walk, but there was no bullet train, no airplane.
Right.
And how hard it would be to hold all this together. These things, they really change the way you look at these wonders of the world, basically. Like the wall, like the Terracotta Army, or like an oasis town. If you go to an oasis town directly from Beijing on a train, you're going to get there and you're going to say, okay, well, this sucks, you know? It's like Albuquerque or something. You get there and you're thinking, okay, well, you know, there's nothing here, and nothing against Albuquerque, but Albuquerque is not really like the most interesting place. It's not New York. If you get there from New York, you're thinking, okay, Albuquerque, you know, I don't know, maybe they have a Walmart or something. But if you walk there from nothing, it's really different.
Right.
It really makes you feel and appreciate Albuquerque has all this water. They have Wendy's. they have a Burger King, they have the Walmart, and they have all these people. You can, you know, you can look at girls for like the first time in 4 days or something, and then it just feels so much different.
Right. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To learn more about the show or to listen to past episodes, check us out on the web at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's get back to our episode. Is there people who walk the Camino de Santiago across northern
yeah.
Spain talk about like the first? There's three stages, really generalized, but I think it helps a lot of people kind of frame and structure the way they're going to think about the walk. That the first part is getting over the physical difficulty of the walk. And whether you're walking a week or 6 weeks, or some people start all the way up in Hamburg and walk all the way to Santiago. And we'll take the months that it takes. But it's that first part, it's getting over the physical, your muscles get ready, the blisters are healed. And then there's a mental stage to that, or psychological stage that comes after. And because the Santiago walk is a spiritual pilgrimage, or could be for many people, they say that third stage is entering into something more spiritual. I'm not trying to throw this at you in terms of trying to make your walk some sort of metaphysical journey, but I'm just curious, did you see stages? Like, is learning how to walk getting over the physical? Is that the first part, really?
The physical for me personally, I don't know if I'm a particularly weak walker, but it didn't really leave me ever. When I started, I had this idea that after maybe a month or 2 months or maybe 6 months, you would be sort of made of steel, and I would have no problems with my feet anymore, no blisters, no nothing. But it never happened. I had problems all the way. So I don't know. The physical thing, also walking through different areas, they pose different problems. You use different equipment. You got to get used to new equipment. You face, like in winter, your daytime walking time is very short. So you get no break at noon because maybe you only have 8 hours.
Right.
But in summer, you can't walk at noon, especially not in the desert. But then what if you don't find a place with shade? So then you're just going to lie down and on the asphalt? That doesn't work either. So you get all these different challenges. It really never stopped challenging me. What I'm trying to say with the learning to walk thing is there are certain things that, like pacing yourself, learning to accept invitations. This is really hard because maybe in the beginning you're full of these insecurities about personal safety, about how the walk is supposed to be your own personal mission, and you don't want that spoiled by the by other people that are kind of taking little bits from it by just being there. But in the end, you realize that it's not so much just about you kind of ego tripping there, but it's about talking to the people that live on that road that kind of give it its unique character.
Right.
And these things you gotta learn. You gotta also learn to come into a place, put your stuff down, and kind of display confidence that you just put it there, and you're not gonna always worry about what happened to your baggage, because you can't worry about your baggage every day of the year. And you gotta kind of learn to relax, and also about how do you eat food. you know, in the Chinese countryside, you, as a European, again, I'm a particularly weak walker. I get sick if I eat stuff that's not, maybe that's too spicy, or stuff that's not prepared to, I don't know, German standards of hygienic boredom. So, yeah, there are some things that you could do. You could chew raw garlic, or you could pick your foods, and that's what you learn,
right?
These things. And then after a while, you realize that, yeah, you even though your feet still hurt, but you know how to deal with blisters, you know how to puncture them, you know how to drain them, and the next day you can continue walking, you know how to sleep, you know what to do when it's noon and there's no shade around. These things you've learned, and then the challenges that the road kind of throws at you, because again, the road has a character and it likes to just kind of, you know, make it interesting for you every once in a while, then you know what to do with them.
Right. So it's kind of adjusting to the rhythms of the day, the temperatures, mm-hmm. the seasons.
Exactly.
Yeah. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show or to listen to podcasts of past episodes, go to www.geographicalimaginations.org. Also, check out our blog section and contribute some comments or ideas you have for future episodes. Now let's get back to our current episode. You know, you don't like to walk that much, but do you plan any other walking trips? Because the way you're describing, like, the perspective that you gain by walking through a place like this, would you do walking again, I guess, to experience some other landscape or other cultural or historical landscape?
Well, you know, because the first time around when I tried to walk from Beijing to Germany, because it's basically the story of a failure. It wasn't like I was physically unable to continue. I was actually just getting warm with the whole learning how to walk idea. But I didn't want to continue at that time. But it didn't really let you go. I continued to walk from where I stopped in 2010 for another 500 kilometers, and then I did the same in 2012. And now, whenever I feel, I don't know, maybe a little bit down or something, I like to just open Google Earth or Google Maps and just kind of look at the places that are ahead. You know, you have these place names like Samarkand or Istanbul or Mashhad, and they just feel very intriguing and magical. So what I'm trying to say is, if I can continue, that would be awesome. Mm-hmm. Even though there are so many interesting places in the world, I would not be able to walk anywhere else but continue this walk, because
right.
It feels like the road actually has its own character. You know, walking on the same band of asphalt for so long, it feels like you're kind of connected to it, and it has these this own character, and I don't want to betray it by walking through, I don't know, South America or something.
Right. So you're connected to it. You feel that connection, and
yeah, that's what happens, I guess.
Yeah. Huh.
It's like people feel connected to their houses, just because they stayed there for so long, with no other reason. You know, any other house could be your house, and you would love it just because you live there.
So the road became, or this route became your home in some ways.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's the same thing as a home, but there is a sort of emotional connection to it, which is very one-sided, because obviously the road doesn't miss me as much as your house would miss you or my house would miss me. But people, they tend to get emotionally attached to things, and I get attached to the road, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we thank Christoph for joining us from Germany and talking to us about his longest way through China. And now we hop on bicycles and join Philip Shouty and his wife Valeska, who spent 5.5 years circumnavigating the globe.
Me and my wife, we started in October 2006, came back to Austria in spring 2012, so we were 5.5 years on the road, did visit 55 countries, made about 87,000 kilometers.
Wow.
Traveled basically all continents, some, you can call it classic routes, or yeah, if you want to call it like that, like from Alaska down to Ushuaia, Terra del Fuego, like
right,
all the Americas, north to south, or
to the Pan American,
Africa, north to south, things like that.
Yeah, is that the Pan American Highway, the Alaska to Ushuaia?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you hardly ever on the Pan American Highway itself, but you follow the Rockies in the north and you follow the Andes in the south, so eventually end up in the southernmost point.
Right. And then in Africa, you said, kind of classic route as well, or?
Yeah, we had the idea of crossing Africa north to south, and that's what we basically did, but we did it a bit longer. We started in October 2006 on the North Cape, like northern Norway, because our first idea was to go from the northernmost, or let's put it that way, where the road starts in the north of Europe until where the road ends down in Africa.
Huh.
Because you basically can do everything on the road. And we did that, started in 2006 on North Cape, and then we ended in the southernmost tip of Africa, which is Cap Agulhas. And we did that in 2007 sometime, I think in January.
Right.
It was, yeah.
So on the whole trip here, do you go back to Austria at all, or are you away for most of it?
We were away for most of it, but we did do some work breaks in between.
Uh-huh.
That means we did not work on the spot, like picking fruits in Australia or things like that.
Right.
But since now it's, I think, about 14 years or so, we're doing expedition crews leading in the Arctic and Antarctic.
Mm-hmm.
So that means Svalbard, Spitsbergen, Greenland, Antarctica. And we did that occasionally in between. So at some point, sometime, we just left the bicycles wherever we were, did take a plane to, let's say, the Arctic, did work for a month, and came back to our bicycles and continued cycling.
Huh.
So that's how we got money on the way. And it was important for us that we can afford the whole trip in that way.
Right. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To learn more about the show or to listen to past episodes, check us out on the web at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's get back to our episode.
Yeah.
But the cycling expedition, I guess one of the things, you know, I've been interested in is how part of it's the logistics. And I know there's a lot of technical, you know, you have to technical aspects of keeping a bicycle going, of resupplying your food and where to get water, all those different sort of aspects. But I think also too, there's this idea of like, how do you come up with your itinerary? And you've said a little bit, like taking kind of the classic routes, but even within those classic routes, you know, did you make decisions about places, you know, based on some kind of ideas that you had, I don't know, to give, you know, did you stay out of certain places of, I'm just thinking in Latin America, maybe certain areas of Colombia or certain areas of that a lot of people have talked about are perhaps maybe more dangerous. Like how did you make those decisions about your itinerary?
I mean, we were, usually we knew like if you take the Americas, we knew we wanted to go from Alaska all the way down to Ushuaia.
Right.
And we started riding, and I mean, the route is more or less you start in the north, you end in the south, and what is in between, it comes as you go. And for us, it was always very important to be in contact with people, to talk with people, see what people on the spot tell us about our next couple of days that we want to cycle. And we occasionally we just completely changed our route due to something people told us, if it's maybe a dangerous place we would go through if we stay on our path, or if there's something special we would need to see to change our route. So there was some planning, of course, talking about Colombia, and you cannot Central America, where you cannot get from Panama to Colombia. You have to get an idea how to cross.
Right, right. The Darien Gap, right?
Yeah, exactly. But basically what we were doing, or how the route really developed, that was sometimes very spontaneous, let's put it that way.
Uh-huh.
And we did not do much with travel guides, guidebooks.
Right.
And we totally got away from any sightseeing or things like that. For us, most important was really to meet people, get in contact with people, and basically see what people tell us about the route.
Right.
And then go after, or go with our own feelings about, for example, dangerous places or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we were quite lucky, I would say. We were never robbed, or nothing ever got stolen. So we
never.
Yeah. Never ever.
Wow.
So even in Central America, where it's really, I mean, you notice, or you can see that, or you have the feeling that it's definitely not the safest places you're traveling in, and
right.
Nobody's on the street once the sun has set. But even there, I mean, people were friendly all over. Wherever we came, we met friendly people, and that became one of the most important things for us, was people. So that was the...
Yeah.
I would say that became why we were traveling, to get in contact with people, to see other cultures, to see and talk with people what they're doing and how things are. And
I mean, there's no doubt, I think, in a trip like that, or journey or expedition like this, that your mind changes about the world and the people in it. Any specific maybe anecdotes or stories that might demonstrate that for the audience a little bit, like certain, I don't know, maybe a certain situation that's really kind of changed your perspective on people in general, whether that's maybe generosity from people or something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, we had it actually from the beginning on, that people got to us and just invited us from the street into their homes to stay there, to eat there, to sleep there. And that was not only in countries where you would, let's say, expect, because people are so curious, because you're so foreign for them.
Right.
It also happened in countries like European countries, or the America, or North America. And we noticed, like, all around the globe, that people basically, it doesn't matter whatever religion they have, or however the political system is, that people basically, they want to live in peace, and they're happy to welcome you in their country. And as I said before, that became really the main part of our travel, to be in contact with people. And I'm just thinking about Africa, because it was in our first year that we were going through Africa. And except for Morocco, I have never been to Africa, and Valeska hasn't been to Africa before as well. And that was a very big question mark. And I mean, you know, in our culture, Africa is a dangerous continent, especially if you think of crossing it with a bicycle.
Right.
So of course you don't know where you're going, and of course you have somehow some fear in you in some way. Mm-hmm. But as you go, you notice that it was actually relatively easy crossing Africa. I mean, of course, you have some parts that are extremely hard for cycling, but from the Bito, it was fantastic continent, very, very interesting. And especially, it's the only continent that we crossed where you're basically always the only white person around. In other areas like take Asia or Central America or South America, I mean there is infrastructure somehow for, let's say, travelers, backpackers.
Right.
Not every day, but maybe every week or every second week.
Right.
And in Africa, you have nothing like that.
Nothing.
And that made the journey really exciting to cross Africa.
Yeah.
And I mean, we crossed a couple of countries where you cannot go at the moment, but I would definitely do it again.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. You're listening to Episode 8, Far and Away. Now let's get back with our guest, Philip Shouty, and ask him about some of those people he and Valeska met along their way.
We were staying with a Syrian family for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the story starts when we were in Athens. There was a Syrian guy who asked us for taking a picture of him, and he was there as a tourist, basically from Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
And then he invited us to his family, and we crossed Aleppo, so we stayed with him for a while.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very nice family, and we had extremely good times together.
Yeah.
And we stayed in contact for the next years, and then when the war broke out, all of a sudden we had no conversation. There was no emails anymore. There was just nothing. And I mean, we of course were worried about this family, and but had no idea what has happened with them.
Yeah.
And then years later, actually, was it a year ago now or so, we again got the email from him and from the father, and they made it out from Syria into Turkey. And actually, I just got a notice from him today that now all family has made it to Denmark, so they're safe and they can stay in Denmark at the moment, which is very good for them.
Yeah. Do you find yourself, I mean, I imagine you're in contact with a number of different families and people, individuals that you've met throughout the 5-year trip.
Yeah.
Is that a big part of what you're doing now, is kind of keeping contact and keeping those relationships going through whether it's emails or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and there are definitely some people who we are in contact with since years that
right.
we met maybe for an evening or something on our trip, but it was just sometimes, you know, it's intense, very intense from the first sentence on, and you just have an evening, but still there's so much you have in common, and you keep contact with people, and there are definitely people who we know since years and who we are still in contact with. Also other cyclists, but lots of people we stayed with all around the globe.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
There's no doubt in my mind that the human landscapes, the cultural landscapes, informed so much of their bicycle trip. But I wanted to ask them about those natural landscapes too, and how much metaphors perhaps from natural landscapes inform our own lives. You're both geographers, right?
That's true.
Yeah, and maybe more physical geographers. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, you're true.
Yeah, so
you're right.
Being physical geographers, I guess one of the things too, I mean, how much did you enjoy kind of riding through the change in landscapes or ecosystems? And is that part of some of the enjoyment of the trip too? I mean, we've been talking about people, and I think that's probably, you know, I'm more of a human geographer. It's very much interesting is the cultural part, but is the physical landscape part just as important?
Definitely. It is, especially if you're going north-south routes. You all have all the different climates you're going through different landscapes that are related to the climate you're traveling in. And with the bicycle, you are in a speed that you can really suck it all in, and you see how the landscape changing slow, but anyway, fast enough that you notice it changing.
Right.
And of course, that's a big part of traveling too. It's not only the people. I mean, people got more and more important for us somehow. But of course, it's also changing landscapes, changing climates, different cultures. Yeah.
So imagine then the world that you see, the world you feel, the change that you can experience by walking and cycling through it, as opposed to driving in a car, as opposed to taking the train, a bus, or worse yet, in this case, flying. The pace in which we walk, 3 miles or 5 kilometers per hour, or in which we cycle, 8 to 10 miles an hour, perhaps 15 kilometers an hour, this grants us in some ways the opportunity to see the world and experience the world at that different pace and with all our senses.
Personally, with the bicycle, I really enjoy to notice countries with all my senses, and that also includes, for example, smelling a country or hearing a country, because there's more than just seeing.
In terms of smell, like, is there the most vivid smelling place? I'm trying to think of a good adjective as apart from best, but is there one place the smell just, like you said, Syria is still with you in some ways in terms of memories. Is there a place its smell is still with you? Or there's probably a number of places. Yeah.
Obviously, there are lots of smells with me. I mean, Australia the outback in Australia has a certain smell.
Uh-huh.
Or I don't know, the dirty roads in big cities in India definitely have a special smell that you only find in India somehow.
Yeah.
I think every country, every place has some special smell as well. And you really notice when you travel that continents smell different somehow.
Yeah. I've always heard people refer to like Mexico as this for the color. And it's whether that's in the architecture, people, the paint of houses, the colors of soils, the just the use of color in so much. If you go to a marketplace, a city or town market, a food market, you would find just so many colors for spices, et cetera, et cetera. Is there, I'm not promoting Mexico by any chance, but is there any truth to that compared to other countries? I mean, because I'm assuming you went through Mexico, probably spent at least a month, right? Or
Mexico, I don't know from how much time we spent there, but I think it was at least a month.
Yeah.
I guess longer.
Right.
But definitely Mexico or Central America is very colorful.
Uh-huh.
Also South America, like the Andean states and what people are wearing and everything, the clothing is very colorful.
Like the typical Andean clothing that men and women would wear? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
The different fabrics, right. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show or to listen to podcasts of past episodes, go to www.geographicalimaginations.org. Also, check out our blog section and contribute some comments or ideas you have for future episodes. Now let's get back to our current episode. So take a long walk, pack up your backpack, pack a few days of food, maybe bring a little stove. Walk across or the length of a river, walk across a watershed, go from one province to the next, change countries, walk across a continent, or take your bike. Maybe you can do it a little faster. Bike the length of Africa. Challenge that time-space compression and see, perhaps, the world at a different pace. I have to think that there's a small world of people at this very moment embarking on or taking on multiple month, multiple region trips, journeys, or as we are calling them, expeditions. Getting out in the world and seeing it, smelling it, tasting it, feeling it, seeing how it changes those natural landscapes, those cultural landscapes, speaking with the world. But I think the question here is, how does our geographical imagination shift? How does that get informed in these trips? I think there's some obvious answers, actually being seeing firsthand the world. But go back to what Philip Shouty told us, and I think this is the most important, perhaps, message of tonight's episode, is by breaking through those more, let's say, those media representations or highly sort of marketed representations of the world, getting beyond those and meeting people, everyday people like you and me, outside of those representations and meeting people face to face from around the world, speaking different languages, following different religions, and just seeing some basic sort of human characteristics, basic human similarities in those characteristics, and seeing and feeling, I guess, then that the world could be different, or the world perhaps is different than the media might represent. I highly recommend, I think there's something interesting about planning an expedition, looking at the maps, seeing where you're going to go, doing the research. Christoph talked about reading for 2 years about the Silk Road, reading a lot of different books about travel narratives, different travelogues of famous sort of expeditions. Grab some books, read some certain different passages, and hopefully plan out your own journey, plan out your own expedition across a landscape, and take that journey and then write your own book. I think in the end, our responsibility, those who do go out on these expeditions, there's a bit of a social responsibility, is to bring those stories between continents, to be the bridge, a cultural ambassador, to write our travelogues, show our photos, give presentations, draw out our own maps. And I think informing the imaginations of those at home, even in the 21st century, is still a responsibility of ours, to step back and see the world from that lens, our local lens back home, and bridge that, what we just learned, our new expeditions out there in the world as a whole, and be that bridge and talk about the world that we met, that we encountered along the way. I think this is part of that time-space compression that we can enter into ourselves. We find the world so close to home, but we are at once showing how close other parts of the world are. But in some ways, we could write the narratives of how we envision that close world. And I think that's the responsibility that we can bring to the table. And so take your expedition and write about it. Show people that another world exists. So we've come to the end of another episode, our eighth. We called it Far and Away. I'd like to thank our guests, Christoph Rehag, coming to us from Germany, and Philip Schaudy, talking to us from his home in Austria. I'd like to talk a little bit about next month's episode. We will talk with Walter Thompson, who's invented the concept of sound painting, and enter into what I hope might be the first of other episodes, looking at the rhythms of cities. So without anything else, I'd like to say thank you for listening, and que les vaya bien. Ciao.